With your permission, we'd like to talk shop for just a moment.
Because we've got a good racket going, you're not going to be able to touch our own.
Oh, okay, so you've got a racket going.
Cookies are not the only food. I tell that to my children all the time.
It's time for the publisher fight. It's time for the publisher fight.
Here's a man that really appreciates that new Ingram Bounce.
Hi, how's it going? And welcome to the Video Week podcast. My name is Vincent Flood. I'm the editor-in-chief at Video Week, and this week's guest is Nicola Lewis. Nicola is the CEO of Fancast, which I'm sure many of you are already familiar with. If you aren't, Fancast operate as a unit within Group M, WPP, and they act as a single point of access for all things addressable TV. The podcast hinges on having excellent guests. I wouldn't keep you entertained too long on my own. And I think my conversation with Nicola is up there with the best of them. The word inspirational is a word that is often used in cheesy LinkedIn posts, often inappropriately. But this conversation, I mean, for me, I came away genuinely inspired by Nicola. And if you listen, you'll understand why. She's had quite a journey on her way to the top, and I think there's a huge amount for anyone in any walk of life to take from this. I've had to take a bit of a break from the podcast, so apologies for the radio silence on the podcast front. We've been working on some other projects, which we'll be able to tell you about soon. We weren't just lying around not doing the podcast. I'll also be able to give you the inside track on our plans for 2024. If you'd like to be involved and be working with us in 2024, we've got a whole range of different events across Europe coming up, and we'd love to be speaking to you. So drop myself a note or Diana Kennedy, our head of partnerships, if you'd like to be involved. Two of the things we have coming up in Q1 that you might be interested in. The first is the video advertising guide for 2024. This is a new guide which will sort of look at the video ecosystem from a cross-channel perspective. So we'll have a little bit on CTV, but the main focus will be on what's happening in online publishing, mobile, social video, what's happening with data and cross-channel measurement. All big issues for 2024, as I think most people will know. And then we'll also be, you know, have landscape maps that chart out the ecosystem. So if your company should be on those, please do get in touch, and we'd love to be speaking to you. Then from March 20th to 21st, we'll be hosting our flagship conference, New Video Frontiers. That one takes place in London. We'll be at BAFTA on day one and at King's Place on day two. So that's March 20th to 21st this year. And we will be having some very exciting speaker announcements about that one in the coming weeks. We've had a fantastic conference. It's been a consistently fantastic conference that we're extremely proud of. And we hope to see you in London for that one this year. Right, now I'll cross over to my conversation with Nicola, and I hope you enjoy. So, Nicola, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Lovely to be here with you today.
Great to have you on. It's been, I know we've been trying to get this in the calendar, but you're a global jet setter, and it's hard to tie you down. But yeah, great we're doing it. One of the things that we've been sort of digging into with a lot of the people on the podcast is, you know, how they got into the industry in the first place. And I think particularly when somebody's risen to the heights that you have, you know, it's interesting to sort of find out what shaped them and how they managed to become a CEO of a major company. So yeah, what was your first beachhead into the industry?
Really interesting, actually. I was one of those people, because I am of that age, who kind of fell into advertising, if you like. So I didn't study Marcoms as a degree, and instead I went to Sussex University and studied social psychology. And my career aspiration was actually to be a criminal psychologist for many, many years as I was growing up. And don't ask why. My mother was always slightly perplexed by that decision. Anyway, I went I went to college, and then off I went to uni, studied for 3 years, and realized to do that level of continuation of psychology was going to take me another 4 years and cost quite a lot more. So I didn't. But interestingly, at the same time, when I went to Sussex University, I was in halls of residence, and I was staying in a relatively basic sort of campus building that housed 12 bedrooms. And one of the people that I was actually living with, you know, as one of that 12, was a person called Jamie Quinn, who I've not connected for a long time with now, but I met his dad, a gentleman called Stephen Quinn, who at that time was the publisher of Vogue. And it's actually it's quite a funny story as to how I actually ended up in advertising, because it was, I think, kind of from that sort of first engagement with Jamie's dad, Stephen Quinn, when he got stuck on the motorway coming down to visit his son, and the only way, I was the only person in the campus building with a car, and so the only way to get him off the side of the A3 between London and Brighton was to go and pick him up, and I feel like he was forever grateful for that. And he gave me my first opportunity when I left university to work in the Vogue sales offices in Hanover Square in London. And so, yeah, that was my first foray into advertising. I was literally grabbing coffees and printing documents out of the printer and sending many, many, many faxes. And learning what it was to sort of work on the sales side of advertising. So that was kind of my first landing in advertising. And then from there, I sort of worked in insights and research. I always really loved insights and research sort of as a discipline, particularly as it supported advertising. But I also had a desire to sort of be on the front line. So back in those days, a lot of the sales team was supported by a team that sat a couple of levels down and crunched all the numbers to create the compelling advertising narrative or story, you know, for clients. And I was one of those people. And I think I then decided, I think I could be quite good at this. And I think I could be quite client focused and client facing. And so I moved into the sort of dizzy worlds of sales. And I actually moved from Condé Nast, working across titles like Vogue and GQ and Brides magazine, to News International I think I would have been a little lowly account manager or an account manager at that time, sort of back in the very early 2000s. And I moved to work at News International for the Sun and the News of the World, which was obviously quite a big departure from Condé Nast, and a really big learning curve. And then I actually up sticks when I was about 26 years old and went traveling for a year with my partner, traveled for 12 months, and then did the thing that is pretty much every parent's nightmare, and never went back, and ended up living in Sydney, Australia, having traveled around South America and extensively through the APAC region, settling in Sydney and making it then my home for 18 years until I returned to Europe 3 months ago. So that was kind of my sort of first journey to sort of working overseas. And then I just worked my way up actually through advertising. I always loved advertising. I'm a people person. I loved, the rate and pace of change in advertising, because it has always changed no matter what period you've worked within it. And yes, then I worked on the sales side within advertising, and I moved into agency land actually at quite a ripe old age of 40, which was a little bit different to the way that other people did it. I think normally many people within the ad media space, you know, tend to work agency side and then flip over into sales. And I did it the other way around, which I did, I think, purely, again, just to learn something new and also kind of sort of bends to my character quite a bit. I tend to like to challenge myself knowingly or not. I tend to sort of have that drive and that challenge. So moved over into the media agency side, which was then a huge shift in my career trajectory.
Yeah, interesting. I think for a lot of people, the shift from buy side to sell side, or the other way around, sell side to buy side, it often just gives them a really strong grounding, and they're a huge asset within their own company in terms of being able to understand the other side and the nuances of it and being able to bring that to their role. So yeah, I find that so often where some of the most interesting people in the industry, they've often had a wide ranging career and sort of seen the different sides to things. I mean, how have things changed in the industry in that time? You know, I mean, and there's been a lot of change in terms of advertising and the transition to digital and like, but culturally, particularly, what kind of changes have you seen within the industry?
I mean, obviously, you know, over a career that spans 25 years, you know, we've moved to a huge proliferation of channels. We've changed to a consumer set that dictate how and when, as opposed to the other way around. You know, obviously, search, social, connected television, performance media, brand media, that wonderful combination between the two, the debate between brand and performance, the level of creativity, you know, within the sector itself. And actually, you know, the talent and the people coming up within the industry, again, themselves, you know, you've moved from a space of, you know, back in the day, media planners, media buyers, sales folk, you know, into organizations that have a mix of data engineers, that have a mix of business strategists, you know, general media strategists, you know, data scientists, etc. I mean, I think it's just changed fundamentally, and absolutely for the good. I always like to think that I have an uncomfortable moment in every one of my days, even now, you know, as I think we should do, because we should always want to be challenged. Our clients are challenging us. We should be ready to ask, you know, why not, what if, you know, and all of that good stuff. And for me, that's what makes, you know, the advertising industry and the advertising sector such a rich and exciting space to be. And I think, you know, back to your point about sort of sales and agency, there used to be a bit of a misnomer that, you know, media agencies and sales were very different places to work in terms of workload and output and capacity, and you know, one being harder than the other, and arguably that always being perceived as the media agency. I think equally now, because of the complexity of media, because of you know, the deep ties to the economy, the changing tides of the economy, both sides are equally as hard at times, equally as rewarding at times, but importantly, I think more connected than ever before, as almost, you know, one industry working for and on behalf of our clients. But I think it's changed hugely, and again, I come back to that point. You know, if I think about me specifically in my career, I've really got used to being uncomfortable and got used to having a high degree of ambiguity within the workplace, within a safe workplace, of course, but always just being challenged by clients. Respectful provocation is something that, you know, I always speak to my team about. And also, you know, because of that complexity, I do think it means that as an industry, we focus a lot more on our crafts and really honing our crafts and being really good at what we do, as opposed to being more sort of generalist in capacity, if you like.
And when you say respectful provocation, what exactly do you mean by that?
I think it's just that challenge piece. You know, we're working with clients who have incredibly, you know, sort of complex business challenges, you know, where they need us to really help them understand the allocation of media in order to, you know, make sure that they move their product off the shelves, that they are growing their share of voice, you know, in an ever complex media system. And I think being media specialists, it's our role to be able to challenge a client on their media approach and on their media strategy. But it's always got to be done respectfully, you know, so that you can ensure continuity, as well as, you know, making some big bets as a client within the media space.
So what was the first agency role that you had when you moved over?
Yeah, so I started in an agency, Mindshare, which is part of Group M, and I was the chief investment officer there. So that was probably, you know, my first big role where I can honestly say that I was uncomfortable in a pleasant way, as in learning a huge amount. But yes, it was the chief investment officer. So working with all of the key and core media partners within Australia to maximize value, achieve first mover advantage from a client perspective with again, all core media owners across all key categories and sectors.
Interesting. And from there, do you move from that role into to become CEO of Fancast or?
No, well, interestingly, I had a bit of a blip then, actually, health-wise. I joined Mindshare in late 2014, and then mid-2016, just over two years into the role. I actually developed breast cancer. So I was diagnosed with breast cancer in July 2016, and I had quite a tough time with that breast cancer. I'd kind of known something was not right just for a few months, and little bit of women's intuition kicked in, and I went for a mammogram, and my world kind of changed overnight, actually. And so within that period, I continued to work at Mindshare, and I had the absolute unwavering support of Group M. And, you know, I'm not saying that just because they're my employee now, you know, but they remain my employee, of course, because I love what we do in Group M and WPP. But actually, there's a big degree of the support that I had from the company as I went through what actually turned out to be a 2-year journey of breast cancer treatment, and actually so much so that I during one of my, well, not during, literally 4 days post one of my final surgeries, I was actually promoted into the chief investment officer of Group M in Australia, which was an amazing feat for me personally, off the back of 2 years of a quite grueling treatment, and also, you know, the fact that the sort of the company took a bet on me. They didn't take a bet on me because, you know, they always said to me, we know that you can do it. We know that you're great. And it also, I think one of the sort of pivotal things on it was that I was the first sort of female chief investment officer within Group M in Australia. So that was all pretty positive. And again, even sort of making that transition through into that new role, I was still doing radiotherapy at the time. So I could only work sort of 2-3 days a week or whenever my energy levels permitted me to, but I was able to be uncomfortable again, learn a new role again, have the support of my people, people in the agencies, people in Group M, and actually the industry as a whole. So yeah, that's what I did before I actually decided to move back overseas and joined the Fancast team on a global level.
It's pretty remarkable the way you sort of started out by describing that as a bit of a blip. I mean, yes. I mean, absolutely incredible. I mean, you know, you hear of people being, you know, I think firstly, just coping with that level of illness, and, you know, psychologically and physically is, you know, a huge achievement for everyone. But to sort of continue with career progression in such a sort of, in that way, and then to come out there, it's like, oh yeah, bit of a blip. No, I mean, I think that probably speaks a huge amount to your character. I mean, you know, having seen friends go through serious diseases, they often come out a different person on the other side. And so far, my experience is that they've come out sort of stronger, and I would say stronger philosophically. Like their outlook on life, what they want from life, becomes a lot clearer in their head. I mean, what was your experience, both, you know, as a person and professionally, in terms of going through all of that?
Yeah. It's such a strange time to think back on. You know, I was in the prime of my life. I my husband and I had, and I'm very open about this because I always hope that this journey does also, you know, anytime I'm happy to share this journey to help other people, because it's a really, really tough period. But my husband and I had purposely chosen not to have children. So that was kind of okay with us. But I mean, that's the first thing that you know, gets spoken about is you know, the impact of fertility, because I had to have chemo. So my tumor was big enough that I was going to have a mastectomy. And I had a bilateral mastectomy, and I was going to have chemotherapy, and I was going to have radiotherapy. So I was going to have, you know, the kind of, as they say, the book thrown at you. So, you know, my career had always been such a big part of me. You know, I used to sometimes call it my sort of, you know, career life, because the two are so intrinsically intertwined. And that is because I do love what I do. I really do. And I love the people I'm surrounded by every single day. And I remember going, so I'd had my mammogram, and they kind of, you know, they put you in the side room, and then you're like, okay, fine. They're not sending me home straight away. And I remember sitting down talking to the doctor, and she said, look, you very clearly have breast cancer, but interesting, couldn't see it. So I didn't have any form of discernible lump, which in a way was so amazing that I did have that woman's intuition to say, I just kind of knew something was wrong. But the first thing she said to me is, your life is on hold now for 12 months at least. And I just remember sitting there going, that doesn't compute for me. What do you mean? I've literally just called my CEO and said, I'll be back in a minute. We've got meetings this afternoon. And instead of doing that, I ended up calling her. And she's this wonderful woman who I will forever hold very, very well in high regard, because she's a brilliant human and excellent at what she does. But just, you know, the way she treated me. Her name's Katie Rigg-Smith. She's the chief strategy officer now for WPP Australia. I ended up calling her saying, hey, you know, okay, this has gone a little bit wrong. I'm not going to be coming back to work. And, you know, I tried to go back to work. I started chemotherapy. My hair fell out. I, you know, oscillated between wigs and scarves, and I couldn't get anything right. So in the end, I opted for a bald head and aviators, because I just figured that it was better to go that way for me personally. Plus it was summer in Sydney. But I also just started to have the, you know, your brain slows down, you're tired, it's really difficult to focus, it's difficult to think. And I always just wanted to be on the top of my game. And it was really important for me from a work perspective. And I remember Katie took me aside for a cup of tea one day, and she said to me, right, I want you to go, and I want you to have at least 6 months off, because I want you to come back the person that you are and how good you are. I don't want you to be here right now. Much as I love you, I want you to go home and rest and focus. And that was probably the best advice that I could have had. Now, I'm not going to take that lightly, because I had a company that was really supportive of me, you know, and obviously not every woman or man has that. So I had a lot of time at home. I had 6 months at home, and I spent 6 months at home with my husband. He worked part-time. And I think, Vincent, I had a couple of life lessons from it. I always say to people, I'm never going to be that person that says I'm pleased I've got cancer because it changed my world, because no one wants to get breast cancer and go through all that treatment when they're 41 years old. It's pretty terrifying. But what it did do is it made me go home, and it made me be present, and it made me plan some stuff that I'd never sort of plan, or that my husband and I'd always had in the back of my mind, or in the back of our mind, you know, like our life plan. And so I think about two things where my world changed. Actually, there's going to be three. The first was about 2 weeks into being at home. I actually apologized to my husband, and I said to him, I'm so sorry. I realized that I have been here with you at home when I haven't been at work, but I haven't been present because I've been on my phone or emails, etc. And I'm really, really sorry about that. And he was wonderful. He said, thank you very much. That means a lot. And so my emails were switched off for 6 months. And so we had this wonderful time, you know, we walked together, we cried together. He came to every appointment with me. He supported me, you know, when I had moments of being crazy and, you know, re-diagnosing myself into a worse stage cancer than I actually had. He's a scientist, which is really helpful. So he deals in facts, which again is really helpful. So I think there was that, like just that wonderful moment of presence. The other one was we set about our life plan to build a house and move to Spain. And so, which is what we've actually ended up doing. So I'm now talking to you from the house we built as a result of that 6 months of chemo in the northern part of Spain, which I love, which we're very proud of, and has taken a lot of blood, sweat and tears, but is actually a result of realizing that dream at a time when you don't know if you're going to live to 60, you know, so what's the point in building a house when you're 60? And that's my world. And then I think that the final really big one for me was just that, like, just having that belief in yourself still because others believe in you. And I remember speaking, so the chief investment officer at Group M at the time I was sick and doing my regular surgeries and chemotherapy, etc., was a guy called Sebastian Rene, and he decided to leave Group M. And I remember calling him one day and I was like, oh, I feel like this is the next role for me, and it's a pivotal role in my career, and it's going to be that next huge challenge where I know I'm going to have to learn lots, but it's going to be fantastic. But why the hell would they hire someone who's just had breast cancer, you know, and doesn't have hair and is still getting her, you know, her thinking process straight again? And he actually turned around to me and he said, you know what, Nick, quite the opposite. He said, everyone is looking at you in awe, just going, how do you keep doing what you're doing? You smile, you walk around in your aviators with no hair. I've gone out and bought myself a car with no roof. I don't know why you do that when you have no hair, but that was just a bit of a dream as well. Like, and it was one of those moments where I'd always wanted one. And my husband was always like, no, totally impractical, but he couldn't argue at this point. He was a bit like, yeah, sure, darling, whatever you want. So Seb actually said to me quite the opposite. And it was that single conversation that just gave me the confidence to say, actually, I can do it. So yeah, I probably would say those were three of the biggest things, the biggest things for me, which then I guess started to then propel me to where I am now. You know, being very present with my husband in this house, looking out sort of over the countryside, and flourishing and really enjoying my career.
There's a huge, I mean, just in everything you just said there, just a few moments of like,
sorry, there's a lot just, in there.
But no, I just kept finding myself going, yeah, God, yeah, I should really do that. Oh yeah, I should really do less of that. I need to be more present. I suppose that was what I was trying to get at with the question, was that I think sometimes these experiences can focus the mind in a way that we come out better, happier, stronger on the other side. And like you say, you wouldn't wish cancer on anyone to get there. And it's, but sometimes, these negative experiences do bring out the best in us as well.
And I think if I think about one, I've just actually done, again, it's Griffin Australia leading the charge on this, but it's going to be obviously a global initiative. But, you know, coming back into the workplace after, you know, after a period out, whether that be motherhood, whether that be illness, whether that be supporting, you know, a family member who is unwell, you know, and I've just been part of a program that's being built about how to step back in after an event like that, because it's not easy. And again, I think, you know, more and more we're seeing that level of support, because, you know, one of the most frightening things, I was just about to say, particularly if you're career focused, but actually it's not one of the most frightening things, is getting back to that sense of normality. It makes my heart feel warm when I start to see, you know, more and more of those programs being created to support people as they come back from experiences like that.
Bereavement is another one. I think that people can often, you know, you maybe get a couple of weeks of people truly remembering what the person's going through, and it's very easy for people to slip into their, you know, normal routine, or, you know, maybe the person can put up a front, but they're actually carrying around this very heavy weight with them every day, and it's difficult. It's difficult to always tell what somebody's going through. So I know you are passionate about Finecast, and we should be speaking about Finecast too. I think for those who don't know, firstly, I mean, what is Finecast? How does it work, and what does it bring to the market?
You're right. I am incredibly passionate about Finecast. I was part of the team in Australia that built Finecast out back in sort of late 2019. Finecast launched its first market in 2017. And obviously now Finecast is part of Group M Nexus, which is, our business that pulls sort of 9,000 sort of professionals together across media solutions, the likes of Finecast, Axis and Sightline, and also expert practices, and whether that be social search, programmatic, data and technology, addressable content, etc. But from the Finecast journey perspective, started back in 2017 in England, and then actually really quickly expanded. So by the time I joined the Finecast global team, which was in early 2021, when I moved over to Europe, to Spain, we were in four markets, and we are now, you know, fast forward 2 years, in upwards of 20 markets. And really, when you think about Finecast and what we do, is we take a increasingly complex ecosystem, CTV, OTV, addressable TV. There are many definitions of that, and we really pull that together into a single point of access, which combines the precision of data at a household level with the wonderful creativity of the big screen. And I think if we think about why Finecast was built in the first place, you know, we know that TV viewing has evolved and will continue to evolve, expanding across all audiences, but at pace. And I think if you were to look at the number of column inches given over to CTV, advanced TV, addressable TV right now, it would be absolutely the most spoken about medium. But of course, along with that, you've got the proliferation of devices and of channels. You've got stricter privacy regulations, you know, and policies. But you've also, there are so many advances in tech and infrastructure that are gonna, well, they're doing it now and will continue to fuel changes in TV consumption over the next decade. And that could be, you know, on the spectrum from 5G connectivity to low orbit satellites, ubiquitous Wi-Fi, new broadcasting standards, etc. And so, again, what we do as Finecast is we look to make the complexity easy. We have a unique proprietary software tool called Finecast Audience Planner that acts as a system that allows us to work with all key broadcasters in core markets, aggregate supply surrounded by premium, professionally produced quality content always. And that's obviously one of our big USPs. Combine that with leading first third-party data sources, plan against household audiences, execute and optimize a holistic approach to the management of reach and frequency also. So in a nutshell, that's what Finecast does. We provide that single access point into a complex ecosystem.
I didn't realize we're up to 20 markets already. I'm curious about which of those, you know, I think a lot of us are going through, you know, sort of hearing a lot of doom and gloom lately. But I'm curious, let's be optimistic and positive. I'm curious about, you know, which of those markets are you most excited about, or which are the most dynamic and interesting and, you know, growing quickly?
So, you know what, I get this question a lot, and you framed it in a really nice way about being optimistic. The question I tend to get quite a lot is, which market's doing it best? And honestly, it's a really difficult answer because every market's doing it slightly differently. So Finecast as a proposition, philosophically, we're the same around the world. So a consistent approach to how we build an end-to-end product. But of course, things like data and supply and the level of segmentation and the level of postcode targeting is different per market. You know, we work with markets like the UK and the US who are incredibly sophisticated within the addressable or advanced TV space. But then we're also working, you know, with markets like India and Indonesia, who are, you know, starting their journeys from a CTV penetration perspective. And so I think it's, I kind of always try and sort of pick out the best of each of the markets. As I said, you know, we've got our big markets like the UK and the US. We're really advanced from a UK perspective. And we're really advanced in areas, you know, particularly in the data space and particularly within the measurement space. Obviously, in the US, you know, an advanced market from a cable TV perspective, cord cutters, obviously are prolific within the US. And you've got such behemoths, would that be NBC Universal, you know, Warner, the likes of Netflix, really spending a lot of money on amazing, great content. You know, so for us there, it's about continuing to work with all of the broadcasters in that market, refine our technology, you know, whether we're using ACR data, additional data partners that allow us to tap into sort of loyalty, commerce, retail data partners, etc. But then, as I said, you've got the likes of an India, you know, where we're starting to see a real increase in penetration of smart TVs within households. And then one of the great things about India is obviously you've got the infrastructure that we've been building as Finecast for about 2 years, and then a plethora of great, great, great content, you know, within the Indian marketplace. I was actually lucky enough to be in Indonesia 2 months ago, launching Finecast in Indonesia. Again, really at that tipping point of connected television uptake from a hardware perspective. And I think then the key for us is working through with our clients, how do we help them on that journey of television transformation? You know, how do we ensure that they can still reach audiences at scale? Where in a lot of markets, supply within the addressable TV space is nascent, you know, and is obviously going to grow. AVOD services, FAST services, hybrid SVOD services. But how do we start clients on that journey moving from that linear TV planning through to a total TV planning philosophy? And then actually, The EMEA market is super interesting. You know, our German team have been incredibly progressed with their build of Finecast using AI optimization as an example through, again, our proprietary GroupM tool, Copilot. We've seen our Spanish team grow exponentially within the 2 years since they launched. And again, that's a lot due to supply growth, you know, data providers becoming more and more accessible and open, and clients willing to go on that journey of total TV transformation. So, you know, for me, when I go to market, I only see positivity. I only see positivity within addressable television and positivity towards Finecast because of the way that we are working with clients. And it's very much hand in glove approach.
So in terms of the growth of supply, I mean, what's driving the growth of supply? I mean, you've obviously got things like, you know, consumer change, but in terms of new companies coming to market outside of broadcasters, yeah, what's driving the main growth and what's the really interesting part for you?
Yeah, look, I mean, obviously, you know, we make sure we sort of follow the consumer in terms of the definition of CTV and what watching TV means in the future. So I think that's one of the important points. You know, obviously, as an industry, we're talking about definitions, acronyms, what means what new entrants, how do you label them? But really, it's about, you know, what is watching TV look like and mean in the future. So we did we actually have a proprietary research platform in the UK called Thinking Inside the Box, and we did a piece of research about 12 months ago just to understand what were consumers and the audience's perception of television. What do they view as television or professionally produced content? And if you ask a younger audience, gaming as an example, 100% is watched on the big screen, and they view that as professionally produced content. They spend a lot of time with it. The quality is good. And certainly as well, the same with BVOD. So the actual definition of television is changing. And so with that, you know, so will the approach to supply. And I think we always look at the future of our supply opportunities or partnerships from a CTV perspective in two ways. So there's one, there's sort of supply as a driver of growth for a market. You know, so some markets, as I said, are supply constrained from CTV inventory, from a CTV inventory perspective. And that is dictated very much market by market, again, depending upon infrastructure. As I said earlier about ubiquitous Wi-Fi, 5G, you know, hardware becoming available. You've got new global players and ad models coming in, you know, taking them into consideration. If we think about the likes of Netflix, Disney Plus, Paramount Plus, and then, you know, we've got this whole new tier of ad-funded opportunities. That opens up a huge amount of opportunity to something that has historically been more of a locally driven TV landscape. And so that is sort of me sort of talking from a global level. But then you've got supply sort of as a driver of innovation. So at Finecast, we don't just focus on supply sort of in isolation, but it's more how do we build on our existing partnerships so that we can drive mutual growth into the total TV space. So that might be contextual targeting, that might be, you know, new methods of advertising within program, virtual product placement, commerce, shoppable ads, really delving into the creative space, just to kind of something we call redefining reach, find that extra reach within the supply pool itself. So supply for us very much does sit in that kind of day to day, but it also very much sits within the innovation bucket as well.
One of the sort of big teething problems I think we've seen in CTV is that, you know, there seems to be a bit of a disconnect when it comes to creative and media. Now sometimes that's fine. You know, I don't think, you know, you necessarily have to have the two completely aligned. But Things like frequency capping have been, you know, haven't exactly been deployed particularly successfully, I think most people would say is their experience. But yeah, that thing of like, you know, how do we get to a point where, you know, the creative works, you know, really well alongside the media, and how do we get the best out of, you know, interactivity?
Yeah. Yeah. Look, you know what, this is something that's super, super close to my heart, and I'm really passionate about at the moment. I mean, I, you know, for me, again, we come back to your first question, like, what do I love about this industry? I love the unification or the combining of media and creative storytelling. If I think about television, you know, arguably every one of us has this wonderful big creative canvas that's sitting in our living room or multiple rooms. And, you know, you see so many great ads made. You know, we see Cannes Lions every year that just has this plethora of awesome, incredible content. And interestingly, and I kind of stay within Finecast and the addressable TV space. 2022, I realize it is now creeping towards the end of 2023. So I should update these numbers. But just for a starting point of where we started to really think about this, in 2022, we just looked at the number of impressions that we had served as Finecast, which was 11 billion addressable TV impressions. How many of them had any form of creative optimization? And it was under 1% out of 11 billion. Now, we forecast that by 2026, we will serve, I say conservatively, between 70 to 80 billion impressions within addressable TV on a global level, which is obviously huge in itself and huge growth. The opportunity within that is absolutely huge. And, you know, we've kind of spent a lot of time, you know, asking ourselves the question or sort of hypothesizing, if we take that 11 billion with less than 1% impressions with any form of creative optimization, are campaigns potentially leaving performance on the table? And arguably the answer has to be yes. You know, we know that effectiveness in, you know, addressable advanced TVs largely been driven through sort of media optimization. And we've always been really focused on that. But I think now is the time to kind of then think about creative optimization within that context and within effectiveness. And we also know, if you look at any sort of industry leading effectiveness data, you know, whether that be Nielsen in the US or IPA in the UK, the largest driver of effectiveness outside of brand size is creativity and creative. And so, yeah, for us as Finecast, this has been a really, really big focus in 2023. We've partnered with a company called System One to really draw down on ad effectiveness within addressable television. And so what we're looking at here is literally using core partners, so creating a framework of brilliant minds within the WPP world across Choreograph, so from a platform data perspective. System One partners within ad effectiveness, Hogarth, the ACP, and then really thinking about what are the areas that we need to think about in this space? So we need to think about early stage strategy recommendations. How do we actually, before we built the creative, start to know what cues are going to land, whether that be fluency, whether that be sort of power rating in terms of emotional connection into the brand? How do we apply those pre-campaign enhancements? How do we build in elements like QR codes and shoppable ads to really help drive performance across key metrics? We did a research study that I could speak at length about, but I won't because we don't have time. And we looked at 46 Finecast clients across a number of core categories just to understand what this framework, how it would come to life, and the types of results that it would drive. You know, and across key categories, we've seen things like 42% increase of cost per conversion, you know, double digit increase in brand awareness, you know, in the hundreds, 170% increase in sales revenue within the retail category, 28% uplift within the finance category and sponsorship awareness, so on and so forth. So it's been really, really interesting for us. And so what we've wanted to do, so we don't boil the ocean, you know, obviously, well, we have an aspiration, as I said, that by 26, every one of those, you know, 70 to 80 billion impressions that we will serve will have some form of creative message optimization, really delivering on that promise of uniting media and creative storytelling. So we don't bore the ocean, you know, we're looking at sort of minimum viable product launch markets, Australia, Germany, obviously UK, Netherlands, Canada, and we'll have a look at India this year as well. So yeah, it's a really, really, really exciting space. But I think it just allows brands to lean in, you know, to personalize creative, take learnings from it, get those consumer cues and push that through into the campaign lifecycle. So yes, we're doing a lot in that space, which is really good.
And in terms of measuring all of this, I think when, you know, even for me, having just trying to remember, you know, what the JIC is called in, you know, Switzerland or whatever, you know, even just within Europe, it gets extremely complicated. It's often fragmented with different approaches, different things that different advertisers or different business cultures value. I'm curious about how you can unify that across 20 markets.
Yeah, I have a great team of people that do that, Vincent. I basically have a marketing science team that will work across, you know, elements, whether that be, look, some markets don't have reach and frequency. So we will go into the market and we will help build out reach and frequency with the industry, or in a bespoke way. So the short answer is we don't have a universal approach to measurement across all markets. We have a team of people that that go into the markets, explore what's available. Are there industry panels? Aren't there? Are there industry panels that are then synthesizing across, you know, linear and BVOD? There aren't that many around the world. How can we join forces? How can we start to build out sort of, you know, measurements that allow us to measure across total TV? Also looking at things like attention. You know, there's a lot of talk around attention at the moment, and I think within CTV it's probably again one of the sort of hottest spaces right now, and it is becoming sort of the next frontier, if you like, for a lot of measurement businesses. And I think TV is a channel, you're in an incredibly strong position to be able to prove out the value of addressable TV in the attention economy. That being said, you know, there is no one size fits all at the moment for attention. So you have to spend a lot of time, you know, really understanding the drivers of attention within addressable, whether that be inventory type, device type, screen size, genre of content type, audience, creative, time of day. What are you measuring? Are you measuring eye tracking, physical response to? So we, you know, we kind of go from reach and frequency in a more nascent market into total TV in more developed markets, and then into attention in markets where really we do feel that we can start to explore attention. And of course, that then measures up into MMM, you know, sort of market mix modeling, a lot around attribution, and then finally sort of into algo modeling. So yeah, to short answer is that we don't have a one size fits all approach, but we try to systematize frameworks that we build based on the nuance in each market. If a JIC is existent in a market, how we can work with them, how we can help supplement. And if I come back to the philosophy of Finecast, it's absolutely about growing the television industry, 100%. And that really is our North Star. You know, I stood on stage in Indonesia the other day, and I hoped it didn't sound too obvious or basic, but I just said, you know, TV's alive and TV's great. Consumers love TV. So that's why for me, it's really important that everything we do is about pulling all of that together. So, yeah, I mean, we have a lot of frameworks regarding measurement. But again, you know, it's about us being able to work with clients in many, many ways, you know, and whether that be, you know, sort of just looking at incremental reach, whether that be increases in footfall, web uplifts, playing 100% in sort of the full funnel, if you like, and bringing that lovely element of brand and performance together within television.
It's never a bad time to remind people about the power of TV, because I think there was a period where people did take their eye off the ball a little bit. There was a lot of innovation happening elsewhere. Yeah. But I think anyway, if you speak to any media planner who, you know, looks at cross-media measurement, that they know that TV is a hugely massive, impactful part of their plan.
100%.
So to finish off, I always offer somebody 10 million of imaginary money to invest. So yeah, I'm curious, which company or sector would you invest in?
Yeah. You know, I thought about this a lot, actually. And I think, and I did do this while I was sick. I tried to raise a lot of money for breast cancer. I would actually invest in research. I would invest in cancer research, whether that be, and particularly sort of, you know, female, although it always touches males as well, you know, breast and ovarian. I've got friends going through ovarian cancer at the moment. And yeah, I feel for me, it would have to be into that sector, because I know it's not a company.
Yeah, no, I think that's a very, very worthwhile sector.
Yeah, and if I didn't do that, I'd probably love to invest something into you know, a grassroots sports club. I love the power of sports on teams and seeing kids get out there and play grassroots sports. So it would probably be there as well. So maybe not terribly sophisticated. I feel like I should say AI. Or something like that, but I'm gonna actually say breast cancer and cancer charity and or, you know, getting kids out playing sports, upping the interest of young girls within sports and investing in grassroots capability there.
I don't think anyone's going to argue with you on any of those fronts. Nicola, that was amazing. When we started the podcast, I think the idea was that we would combine the human with the industry chat. And I feel like, yeah, you met the brief.
And then some.
Really, that was a fantastic episode. And thanks so much for joining me.
Vincent, thank you. It's been an absolute pleasure to talk to you. Thank you so much. And have a fab day.